Part 1. Orientation. Column by column, row by row. Chapter 1. Geography is destiny. Helium, boron, antimony, thulium, oxygen, holmium. When most people think of the periodic table, they remember a chart hanging on the front wall of their high school chemistry class, an asymmetric expanse of columns and rows looming over one of the teacher's shoulders. The chart was usually enormous, 6 by 4 feet or so, a size both daunting and appropriate given its importance to chemistry. It was introduced to the class in early September and was still relevant in late May, and it was the one piece of scientific information that, unlike lecture notes or textbooks, you were encouraged to consult during exams. Of course, part of the frustration you might remember about the periodic table could flow from the fact that, despite its being freely available to fall back on, a gigantic and fully sanctioned cheat sheet, it remained less than frickin' helpful. On the one hand, the periodic table seemed organized and honed, almost German-engineered for maximum scientific utility. On the other hand, it was such a jumble of long numbers, abbreviations, and what looked for all the world like computer error messages, XE6S24FL15D1, it was hard not to feel anxious. And although the periodic table obviously had something to do with other sciences, such as biology and physics, it wasn't clear what exactly. Probably the biggest frustration for many students was that the people who got the periodic table, who could really unpack how it worked, could pull so many facts from it with such dweeby nonchalance. It was the same irritation colorblind people must feel when the fully sighted find sevens and nines lurking inside those party-colored dot diagrams. Crucial but hidden information that never quite resolves itself into coherence. People remember the table with a mix of fascination, fondness, inadequacy, and loathing. Before introducing the periodic table, every teacher should strip away all the clutter and have students just stare at the thing. Blank. What does it look like? Sort of like a castle, with an uneven main wall, as if the royal masons hadn't quite finished building up the left-hand side, and tall, defensive turrets on both ends. It has 18 jagged columns and 7 horizontal rows, each with a landing strip of 2 extra rows hanging below. The castle is made of bricks, and the first non-obvious thing about it is that the bricks are not interchangeable. Each brick is an element or type of substance. As of now, 112 elements, with a few more pending, make up the table, and the entire castle would crumble if any of those bricks didn't sit exactly where it does. That's no exaggeration. If scientists determined that one element somehow fit into a different slot, or that 2 of the elements could be swapped, the entire edifice would tumble down. Another architectural curiosity is that the castle is made up of different materials in different areas. That is, not all the bricks are made of the same substance, nor do they have the same characteristics. 75% of the bricks are metals, which means most elements are cold, gray solids, at least at temperatures human beings are used to. A few columns on the eastern side contain gases. Only 2 elements, mercury and bromine, are liquids at room temperature. In between the metals and gases, about where Kentucky sits on a U.S. map, lie some hard-to-define elements whose amorphous nature gives them interesting properties, such as the ability to make acids billions of times stronger than anything locked up in the chemical supply room. Overall, if each brick was made of the substance it represented, the castle of the elements would be a chimera, with additions and wings from incongruent eras, or, more charitably, a Daniel Libeskind building, with seemingly incompatible materials grafted together into an elegant whole. The reason for lingering over the blueprints of the castle walls is that the coordinates of an element determine nearly everything scientifically interesting about it. For each element, its geography is its destiny. In fact, now that you have a sense of what the table looks like in outline, I can switch to a more useful metaphor. The periodic table as a map. And to sketch in a bit more detail, I'm going to plot this map from east to west, lingering over both well-known and out-of-the-way elements. First up, in column 18 at the far right-hand side, is a set of elements known as the noble gases. Noble is an archaic, funny-sounding word, less chemistry than ethics or philosophy. And indeed, the term noble gases goes back to the birthplace of Western philosophy, ancient Greece. There, after his fellow Greeks Leucippus and Democritus invented the idea of atoms, Plato minted the word elements, in Greek, stoicheia, as a general term for different small particles of matter. Plato, who left Athens for his own safety after the death of his mentor Socrates around 400 BC and wandered around writing philosophy for years, of course lacked knowledge of what an element really is in chemistry terms. But if he had known, he no doubt would have selected the elements on the eastern edge of the table, especially helium, as his favorites. In his dialogue on love and the erotic, The Symposium, Plato claimed that every being longs to find its complement, its missing half. When applied to people, this implies passion and sex and all the troubles that accompany passion and sex. In addition, Plato emphasized throughout his dialogues that abstract and unchanging things are intrinsically more noble than things that grub around and interact with gross matter. This explains why he adored geometry with its idealized circles and cubes, objects perceptible only to our reason. For non-mathematical objects, Plato developed a theory of forms which argued that all objects are shadows of one ideal type. All trees, for instance, are imperfect copies of an ideal tree whose perfect tree-ness they aspire to. The same with fish and fish-ness, or even cups and cup-ness. Plato believed that these forms were not merely theoretical, but actually existed, even if they floated around in an Empyrean realm beyond the direct perception of humans. He would have been as shocked as anyone then when scientists began conjuring up ideal forms on Earth with helium. In 1911, a Dutch-German scientist was cooling mercury with liquid helium when he discovered that below negative 452 degrees Fahrenheit, the system lost all electrical resistance and became an ideal conductor. This would be sort of like cooling an iPod down to hundreds of degrees below zero and finding that the battery remained fully charged no matter how long or loud you played music, until infinity, as long as the helium kept the circuitry cold. A Russian-Canadian team pulled an even neater trick in 1937 with pure helium. When cooled down to negative 456 degrees Fahrenheit, helium turned into a superfluid with exactly zero viscosity and zero resistance to flow. Perfect fluidness. Superfluid helium defies gravity and flows uphill and over walls. At the time, these were flabbergasting finds. Scientists often fudge and pretend that effects like friction equal zero, but only to simplify calculations. Not even Plato predicted that someone would actually find one of his ideal forms. Helium is also the best example of elementness, a substance that cannot be broken down or altered by normal chemical means. It took scientists 2,200 years from Greece in 400 BC to Europe in 1800 AD to grasp what elements really are, because most are too changeable. It was hard to see what made carbon carbon when it appeared in thousands of compounds, all with different properties. Today, we would say that carbon dioxide, for instance, isn't an element because one molecule of it divides into carbon and oxygen. But carbon and oxygen are elements because you cannot divide them more finely without destroying them. Returning to the theme of the symposium and Plato's theory of erotic longing for a missing half, we find that virtually every element seeks out other atoms to form bonds with, bonds that mask its nature. Even most pure elements, such as oxygen molecules in the air, O2, always appear as composites in nature. Yet scientists might have figured out what elements are much sooner had they known about helium, which has never reacted with another substance, has never been anything but a pure element. Author's note: Two scientists observed the first evidence for helium, an unknown spectral line in the yellow range, during an eclipse in 1868, hence the element's name, from Helios, Greek for sun. The element was not isolated on Earth until 1895, through the careful isolation of helium from rocks. For more on this, see Chapter 17. For 8 years, helium was thought to exist on Earth in minute quantities only, until miners found a huge underground cache in Kansas in 1903. They had tried to light the gas shooting out of a vent in the ground on fire, but it wouldn't catch. Helium acts this way for a reason. All atoms contain negative particles called electrons, which reside in different tiers or energy levels inside the atom. The levels are nested concentrically inside each other, and each level needs a certain number of electrons to fill itself and feel satisfied. In the innermost level, that number is 2. In other levels, it's usually 8. Elements normally have equal numbers of negative electrons and positive particles called protons, so they're electrically neutral. Electrons, however, can be freely traded between atoms, and when atoms lose or gain electrons, they form charged atoms called ions. What's important to know is that atoms fill their inner, lower energy levels as full as possible with their own electrons, then either shed, share, or steal electrons to secure the right number in the outermost level. Some elements share or trade electrons diplomatically, while others act very nasty. That's half of chemistry in one sentence. Atoms that don't have enough electrons in the outer level will fight, barter, beg, make and break alliances, or do whatever they must to get the right number. Helium, element 2, has exactly the number of electrons it needs to fill its only level. This closed configuration gives helium tremendous independence because it doesn't need to interact with other atoms or share or steal electrons to feel satisfied. Helium has found its erotic complement in itself. What's more, that same configuration extends down the entire 18th column beneath helium, the gases neon, argon, krypton, xenon, and radon. All these elements have closed shells with full complements of electrons, so none of them reacts with anything under normal conditions. That's why, despite all the fervid activity to identify and label elements in the 1800s, including the development of the periodic table itself, no one isolated a single gas from column 18 before 1895. That aloofness from everyday experience, so like his ideal spheres and triangles, would have charmed Plato. And it was that sense the scientists who discovered helium and its brethren on Earth were trying to evoke with the name noble gases. Or, to put it in Plato-like words, he who adores the perfect and unchangeable and scorns the corruptible and ignoble will prefer the noble gases by far to all other elements. For they never vary. Never waver, never pander to other elements like hoi polloi offering cheap wares in the marketplace. They are incorruptible and ideal. The repose of the noble gases is rare, however. One column to the west sits the most energetic and reactive gases on the periodic table, the halogens. And if you think of the table wrapping around like a Mercator map so that east meets west and column 18 meets column 1, even more violent elements appear on the western edge, the alkali metals. The pacifist noble gases are a demilitarized zone surrounded by unstable neighbors. Despite being normal metals in some ways, the alkalis, instead of rusting or corroding, can spontaneously combust in air or water. They also form an alliance of interests with the halogen gases. The halogens have 7 electrons in the outer layer, one short of the octet they need, while the alkalis have 1 electron in the outer level and a full octet in the level below. So it's natural for the latter to dump their extra electron on the former and for the resulting positive and negative ions to form strong links. This sort of linking happens all the time, and for this reason, electrons are the most important part of an atom. They take up virtually all an atom's space, like clouds swirling around an atom's compact core, the nucleus. That's true even though the components of the nucleus, protons and neutrons, are far bigger than individual electrons. If an atom were blown up to the size of a sports stadium, the proton-rich nucleus would be a tennis ball at the 50-yard line. Electrons would be pinheads flashing around it. But flying so fast and knocking into you so many times per second that you wouldn't be able to enter the stadium. They'd feel like a solid wall. As a result, whenever atoms touch, the buried nucleus is mute. Only the electrons matter. Author's note: to reiterate the point about atoms being mostly empty space, Alan Blackman, a chemist at the University of Otago in New Zealand, wrote in the January 28, 2008 Otago Daily Times, "Consider the most dense known element, iridium. A sample of this, the size of a tennis ball, would weigh just over 3 kilograms, 6.6 pounds. Let's assume that we could somehow pack the iridium nuclei together as tight as we possibly could, thereby eliminating most of that empty space. A tennis ball-sized sample of this compacted material would now weigh an astonishing 7 trillion tons, 7.7 trillion U.S. tons. As a footnote to this footnote, no one really knows whether iridium is the densest element. Its density is so close to osmium's that scientists cannot distinguish between them, and in the past few decades they've traded places as king of the mountain. Osmium is on top at the moment. One quick caveat: don't get too attached to the image of electrons as discrete pinheads flashing about a solid core, or in the more usual metaphor, don't necessarily think of electrons as planets circling a nucleic sun. The planet analogy is useful, but as with any analogy, it's easy to take too far, as some renowned scientists have found out to their chagrin. Bonding between ions explains why combinations of halogens and alkalis, such as sodium chloride, table salt, are common. Similarly, elements from columns with two extra electrons, such as calcium, and elements from columns that need two extra electrons, such as oxygen, frequently align themselves. It's the easiest way to meet everyone's needs. Elements from non-reciprocal columns also match up according to the same laws. Two ions of sodium, Na+, take on one of oxygen, O2, to form sodium oxide, Na2O. Calcium chloride combines as CaCl2 for the same reasons. Overall, you can usually tell at a glance how elements will combine by noting their column numbers and figuring out their charges. The pattern all falls out of the table's pleasing left-right symmetry. Unfortunately, not all of the periodic table is so neat and clean, but the raggedness of some elements actually makes them interesting places to visit. There's an old joke about a lab assistant who bursts into a scientist's office one morning hysterical with joy despite a night of uninterrupted work. The assistant holds up a fizzing, hissing, corked bottle of green liquid and exclaims he has discovered a universal solvent. His sanguine boss peers at the bottle and asks, "And what is a universal solvent?" The assistant sputters, "An acid that dissolves all substances." After considering this thrilling news, not only would this universal acid be a scientific miracle, it would make both men billionaires, the scientist replies, "How are you holding it in a glass bottle?" It's a good punchline, and it's easy to imagine Gilbert Lewis smiling, perhaps poignantly. Electrons drive the periodic table, and no one did more than Lewis to elucidate how electrons behave and form bonds in atoms. His electron work was especially illuminating for acids and bases, so he would have appreciated the assistant's absurd claim. More personally, the punchline might have reminded Lewis how fickle scientific glory can be. A wanderer, Lewis grew up in Nebraska, attended college and graduate school in Massachusetts around 1900, and then studied in Germany under chemist Walter Nernst. Life under Nernst proved so miserable for legitimate and merely perceived reasons that Lewis returned to Massachusetts for an academic post after a few months. That, too, proved unhappy, so he fled to the newly conquered Philippines to work for the U.S. government, taking with him only one book, Nernst's Theoretical Chemistry, so he could spend years rooting out and obsessively publishing papers on every quibbling error. Eventually, Lewis grew homesick and settled at the University of California at Berkeley, where over 40 years he built Berkeley's chemistry department into the world's best. Though it may sound like a happy ending, it wasn't. The singular fact about Lewis is that he was probably the best scientist never to win the Nobel Prize, and he knew it. No one ever received more nominations, but his naked ambition and a trail of disputes worldwide poisoned his chances of getting enough votes. He soon began resigning, or was forced to resign, from prestigious posts in protest and became a bitter hermit. Apart from personal reasons, Lewis never secured the Nobel Prize because his work was broad rather than deep. He never discovered one amazing thing, something you could point to and say, wow. Instead, he spent his life refining how an atom's electrons work in many contexts, especially the class of molecules known as acids and bases. In general, whenever atoms swap electrons to break or form new bonds, chemists say they've reacted. Acid-base reactions offer a stark and often violent example of those swaps, and Lewis's work on acids and bases did as much as anyone's to show what exchanging electrons means on a submicroscopic level. Before about 1890, scientists judged acids and bases by tasting or dunking their fingers in them, not exactly the safest or most reliable methods. Within a few decades, scientists realized that acids were, in essence, proton donors. Many acids contain hydrogen, a simple element that consists of one electron circling one proton. That's all hydrogen has for nucleus. When an acid like hydrochloric acid, HCl, mixes with water, it fissures into H+ and Cl-. Removing the negative electron from the hydrogen leaves just a bare proton, the H+, which swims away on its own. Weak acids like vinegar pop a few protons into solution, while strong acids like sulfuric acid flood solutions with them. Lewis decided this definition of an acid limited scientists too much, since some substances act like acids without relying on hydrogen. So Lewis shifted the paradigm. Instead of saying that H+ splits off, he emphasized that Cl- absconds with its electron. Instead of a proton donor, then, an acid is an electron thief. In contrast, bases such as bleach or lye, which are the opposites of acids, might be called electron donors. These definitions, in addition to being more general, emphasize the behavior of electrons, which fits better with the electron-dependent chemistry of the periodic table. Although Lewis laid this theory out in the 1920s and 1930s, scientists are still pushing the edge of how strong they can make acids using his ideas. Acid strength is measured by the pH scale, with lower numbers being stronger. And in 2005, a chemist from New Zealand invented a boron-based acid called a carborane, with a pH of minus 18. To put that in perspective, water has a pH of 7, and the concentrated HCl in our stomachs has a pH of 1. But according to the pH scale's unusual accounting methods, dropping one unit, e.g. from 4 to 3, boosts an acid's strength by 10 times. So moving from stomach acid at 1 to the boron-based acid at minus 18 means the latter is 10 billion billion times stronger. That's roughly the number of atoms it would take to stack them to the moon. There are even worse acids based on antimony, an element with probably the most colorful history on the periodic table. Nebuchadnezzar, the king who built the Hanging Gardens of Babylon in the 6th century BC, used a noxious antimony lead mix to paint his palace walls yellow. Perhaps not coincidentally, he soon went mad, sleeping outdoors in fields and eating grass like an ox. Around that same time, Egyptian women were applying a different form of antimony as mascara, both to decorate their faces and to give themselves witch-like powers to cast the evil eye on enemies. Later, medieval monks, not to mention Isaac Newton, grew obsessed with the sexual properties of antimony and decided this half-metal, half-insulator, neither one thing nor the other, was a hermaphrodite. Antimony pills also won fame as laxatives. Unlike modern pills, these hard antimony pills didn't dissolve in the intestines, and the pills were considered so valuable that people rooted through fecal matter to retrieve and reuse them. Some lucky families even passed down laxatives from father to son. Perhaps for this reason, antimony found heavy work as a medicine, although it's actually toxic. Mozart probably died from taking too much to combat a severe fever. Author's note. Other facts about antimony. Number 1. Much of our knowledge of alchemy and antimony comes from a 1604 book, The Triumphal Chariot of Antimony, written by Johann Tolda. To give his book a publicity boost, Tolda claimed he'd merely translated it from a 1450 text written by a monk, Basilius Valentinus. Fearing persecution for his beliefs, Valentinus had supposedly hidden the text in a pillar in his monastery. It remained hidden until a miraculous thunderbolt split the pillar in Tolda's time and allowed him to discover the manuscript. Number 2. Although many did call antimony a hermaphrodite, others insisted it was the essence of femininity, so much so that the alchemical symbol for antimony became the general symbol for female. Number 3. In the 1930s in China, a poor province made do with what it had and decided to make money from antimony, about the only local resource. But antimony is soft, easily rubbed away, and slightly toxic, all of which makes for poor coins, and the government soon withdrew them. Though worth just fractions of a cent then, these coins fetch thousands of dollars from collectors today. Scientists eventually got a better handle on antimony. By the 1970s, they realized that its ability to hoard electron-greedy elements around itself made it wonderful for building custom acids. The results were as astounding as the helium superfluids. Mixing antimony pentafluoride, SPF5, with hydrofluoric acid, HF, produces a substance with a pH of minus 31. This super acid is 100,000 billion 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 times more potent than stomach acid, and will eat through glass as ruthlessly as water through paper. You couldn't pick up a bottle of it because after it ate through the bottle, it would dissolve your hand. To answer the professor in the joke, it's stored in special Teflon-lined containers. To be honest, though, calling the antimony mix the world's strongest acid is kind of cheating. By themselves, SPF5, an electron thief, and HF, a proton donor, are nasty enough. But you have to sort of multiply their complementary powers together by mixing them before they attain superacid status. They're strongest only under contrived circumstances. Really, the strongest solo acid is still the boron-based carborane, HCB11, Cl11. And this boron acid has the best punchline so far. It's simultaneously the world's strongest and gentlest acid. To wrap your head around that, remember that acids split into positive and negative parts. In carborane's case, you get H plus and an elaborate cage-like structure formed by everything else, CB11, Cl11 minus. With most acids, it's the negative portion that's corrosive and caustic and eats through skin, but the boron cage forms one of the most stable molecules ever invented. Its boron atoms share electrons so generously that it practically becomes helium, and it won't go around ripping electrons from other atoms, the usual cause of acidic carnage. So what's carborane good for if not dissolving glass bottles or eating through bank vaults? It can add an octane kick to gasoline, for one thing, and make vitamins digestible. More important is its use in chemical cradling. Many chemical reactions involving protons aren't clean, quick swaps. They require multiple steps, and protons get shuttled around in millions of billionths of seconds, so quickly scientists have no idea what really happened. Carborane, though, because it's so stable and unreactive, will flood a solution with protons, then freeze the molecules at crucial intermediate points. Carborane holds the intermediate species up on a soft, safe pillow. In contrast, antimony superacids make terrible cradles because they shred the molecules scientists most want to look at. Lewis would have enjoyed seeing this and other applications of his work with electrons and acids, and it might have brightened the last dark years of his life. Although he did government work during World War I and made valuable contributions to chemistry until he was in his 60s, he was passed over for the Manhattan Project during World War II. This galled him, since many chemists he had recruited to Berkeley played important roles in building the first atomic bomb and became national heroes. In contrast, he puttered around during the war, reminiscing and writing a wistful pulp novel about a soldier. He died alone in his lab in 1946. There's general agreement that after smoking 20-some cigars per day for 40-plus years, Lewis died of a heart attack. But it was hard not to notice that his lab smelled like bitter almonds, a sign of cyanide gas, the afternoon he died. Lewis used cyanide in his research, and it's possible he dropped a canister of it after going into cardiac arrest. Then again, Lewis had had lunch earlier in the day, a lunch he'd initially refused to attend, with a younger, more charismatic rival chemist who had won the Nobel Prize and served as a special consultant to the Manhattan Project. It's always been in the back of some people's minds that the honored colleague might have unhinged Lewis. If that's true, his facility with chemistry might have been both convenient and unfortunate. In addition to reactive metals on its west coast and halogens and noble gases up and down its east coast, the periodic table contains a great plains that stretches right across its middle, columns 3 through 12, the transition metals. To be honest, the transition metals have exasperating chemistry, so it's hard to say anything about them generally, except be careful. You see, heavier atoms like the transition metals have more flexibility than other atoms in how they store their electrons. Like other atoms, they have different energy levels, designated 1, 2, 3, etc., with lower energy levels buried beneath higher levels. And they also fight other atoms to secure full outer energy levels with 8 electrons. Figuring out what counts as the outer level, however, is trickier. As we move horizontally across the periodic table, each element has one more electron than its neighbor to the left. Sodium, element 11, normally has 11 electrons. Magnesium, element 12, has 12 electrons, and so on. As elements swell in size, they not only sort electrons into energy levels, they also store those electrons in different shaped bunks called shells. But atoms, being unimaginative and conformist, fill shells and energy levels in the same order as we move across the table. Elements on the far left-hand side of the table put the first electron in an S shell, which is spherical. It's small and holds only 2 electrons, which explains the 2 taller columns on the left side. After these first 2 electrons, atoms look for something roomier. Jumping across the gap, elements in the columns on the right-hand side begin to pack new electrons one by one into a P shell, which looks like a misshapen lung. P shells can hold 6 electrons, hence the 6 taller columns on the right. Notice that across each row near the top, the 2 S shell electrons plus the 6 P shell electrons add up to 8 electrons total, the number most atoms want in the outer shell. And except for the self-satisfied noble gases, all these elements' outer shell electrons are available to dump onto or react with other atoms. These elements behave in a logical manner. Add a new electron, and the atom's behavior should change, since it has more electrons available to participate in reactions. Now for the frustrating part. The transition metals appear in columns 3 through 12 of the 4th through 7th rows, and they start to file electrons into what are called D shells, which hold 10 electrons. D shells look like nothing so much as misshapen balloon animals. Based on what every other previous element has done with its shells, you'd expect the transition metals to put each extra D shell electron on display in an outer layer, and for that extra electron to be available for reactions too. But no. Transition metals squirrel their extra electrons away and prefer to hide them beneath other layers. The decision of the transition metals to violate convention and bury their D-shell electrons seems ungainly and counterintuitive. Plato would not have liked it. It's also how nature works, and there's not much we can do about it. There's a payoff to understanding this process. Normally, as we move horizontally across the table, the addition of one electron to each transition metal would alter its behavior, as happens with elements in other parts of the table. But because the metals bury their D-shell electrons in the equivalent of false-bottomed drawers, those electrons end up shielded. Other atoms trying to react with metals cannot get at those electrons, and the upshot is that many metals in a row leave the same number of electrons exposed. They therefore act the same way chemically. That's why, scientifically, many metals look so indistinguishable and act so indistinguishably. They're all cold, gray lumps because their outer electrons leave them no choice but to conform. Of course, just to confuse things, sometimes buried electrons do rise up and react. That's what causes the slight differences between some metals. That's also why their chemistry is so exasperating. F-shell elements are similarly messy. F-shells begin to appear in the first of the two free-floating rows of metals beneath the periodic table, a group called the lanthanides. They're also called the rare earths, and according to their atomic numbers, 57 through 71, they really belong in the sixth row. They were relegated to the bottom to make the table skinnier and less unwieldy. The lanthanides bury new electrons even more deeply than the transition metals, often two energy levels down. This means that they are even more alike than the transition metals and can barely be distinguished from one another. Moving along the row is like driving from Nebraska to South Dakota and not realizing you've crossed the state line. It's impossible to find a pure sample of a lanthanide in nature since its brothers always contaminated. In one famous case, a chemist in New Hampshire tried to isolate thulium, element 69. He started with huge casserole dishes of thulium-rich ore and repeatedly treated the ore with chemicals and boiled it, a process that purified the thulium by a small fraction each time. The dissolving took so long that he could only do one or two cycles per day at first, yet he repeated this tedious process 15,000 times by hand and winnowed the hundreds of pounds of ore down to just ounces before the purity satisfied him. Even then, there was still a little cross-contamination from other lanthanides, whose electrons were buried so deep there just wasn't enough of a chemical handle to grasp them and pull them out. Electron behavior drives the periodic table. But to really understand the elements, you can't ignore the part that makes up more than 99% of their mass, the nucleus. And whereas electrons obey the laws of the greatest scientist never to win the Nobel Prize, the nucleus obeys the dictates of probably the most unlikely Nobel laureate ever, a woman whose career was even more nomadic than Lewis's. Maria Gueppert was born in Germany in 1906. Even though her father was a sixth-generation professor, Maria had trouble convincing a PhD program to admit a woman, so she bounced from school to school, taking lectures wherever she could. She finally earned her doctorate at the University of Hanover, defending her thesis in front of professors she'd never met. Not surprisingly, with no recommendations or connections, no university would hire her upon her graduation. She could enter science only obliquely, through her husband, Joseph Mayer, an American chemistry professor visiting Germany. She returned to Baltimore with him in 1930, and the newly named Gueppert Mayer began tagging along with Mayer to work and conferences. Unfortunately, Mayer lost his job several times during the Great Depression, and the family drifted to universities in New York and then Chicago. Most schools tolerated Gueppert Mayer's hanging around to chat science. Some even condescended to give her work, though they refused to pay her, and the topics were stereotypically feminine, such as figuring out what causes colors. After the Depression lifted, hundreds of her intellectual peers gathered for the Manhattan Project, perhaps the most vitalizing exchange of scientific ideas ever. Gerbert Mayer received an invitation to participate, but peripherally, on a useless side project to separate uranium with flashing lights. No doubt she chafed in private, but she craved science enough to continue to work under such conditions. After World War II, the University of Chicago finally took her seriously enough to make her a professor in physics. Although she got her own office, the department still didn't pay her. Nevertheless, bolstered by the appointment, she began to work in 1948 on the nucleus, the core and essence of an atom. Inside the nucleus, the number of positive protons, the atomic number, determines the atom's identity. In other words, the atom cannot gain or lose protons without becoming a different element. Atoms do not normally lose neutrons either, but an element's atoms can have different numbers of neutrons, variations called isotopes. For instance, the isotopes lead-204 and lead-206 have identical atomic numbers, 82, but different numbers of neutrons, 122 and 124. The atomic number plus the number of neutrons is called the atomic weight. It took scientists many years to figure out the relationship between atomic number and atomic weight, but once they did, periodic table science got a lot clearer. Gerbert Mayer knew all of this, of course, but her work touched on a mystery that was more difficult to grasp. A deceptively simple problem. The simplest element in the universe, hydrogen, is also the most abundant. The second simplest element, helium, is the second most abundant. In an aesthetically tidy universe, the third element, lithium, would be the third most abundant, and so on. Our universe isn't tidy. The third most common element is oxygen, element 8. But why? Scientists might answer that oxygen has a very stable nucleus, so it doesn't disintegrate or decay. But that only pushed the question back. Why do certain elements, like oxygen, have such stable nuclei? Unlike most of her contemporaries, Gerbert Mayer saw a parallel here to the incredible stability of noble gases. She suggested that protons and neutrons in the nucleus sit in shells just like electrons, and that filling nuclear shells leads to stability. To an outsider, this seems reasonable, a nice analogy. But Nobel Prizes aren't won on conjectures, especially those by unpaid female professors. What's more, this idea ruffled nuclear scientists, since chemical and nuclear processes are independent. There's no reason why dependable, stay-at-home neutrons and protons should behave like tiny, capricious electrons, which abandon their homes for attractive neighbors. And mostly they don't. Except Gerbert Mayer pursued her hunch, and by piecing together a number of unlinked experiments, she proved that nuclei do have shells and do form what she called magic nuclei. For complex mathematical reasons, magic nuclei don't reappear periodically like elemental properties. The magic happens at atomic numbers 2, 8, 20, 28, 50, 82, and so on. Gerbert Mayer's work proved how, at those numbers, protons and neutrons marshal themselves into highly stable, highly symmetrical spheres. Notice, too, that oxygen's 8 protons and 8 neutrons make it doubly magic and therefore eternally stable, which explains its seeming overabundance. This model also explains at a stroke why elements such as calcium, 20, are disproportionately plentiful and, not incidentally, why our bodies employ these readily available minerals. Gerbert Mayer's theory echoes Plato's notion that beautiful shapes are more perfect, and her model of magic orb-shaped nuclei became the ideal form against which all nuclei are judged. Conversely, elements stranded far between two magic numbers are less abundant because they form ugly, oblong nuclei. Scientists have even discovered neutron-starved forms of holmium, element 67, that give birth to a deformed, wobbly, football nucleus. As you might guess from Gerbert Mayer's model or from ever having watched somebody fumble during a football game, The holmium footballs aren't very steady. And unlike atoms with misbalanced electron shells, atoms with distorted nuclei can't poach neutrons and protons from other atoms to balance themselves. So atoms with misshapen nuclei, like that form of holmium, hardly ever form and immediately disintegrate if they do. The nuclear shell model is brilliant physics. That's why it no doubt dismayed Gupert Mayer, given her precarious status among scientists, to discover that it had been duplicated by male physicists in her homeland. She risked losing credit for everything. However, both sides had produced the idea independently, and when the Germans graciously acknowledged her work and asked her to collaborate, Gupert Mayer's career took off. She won her own accolades, and she and her husband moved a final time in 1959 to San Diego, where she began a real, paying job at the new University of California campus there. Still, she never quite shook the stigma of being a dilettante. When the Swedish Academy announced in 1963 that she had won her profession's highest honor, the San Diego newspaper greeted her big day with the headline, "SD Mother Wins Nobel Prize." But maybe it's all a matter of perspective. Newspapers could have run a similarly demeaning headline about Gilbert Lewis, and he probably would have been thrilled. Reading the periodic table across each row reveals a lot about the elements. But that's only part of the story, and not even the best part. Elements in the same column, latitudinal neighbors, are actually far more intimately related than horizontal neighbors. People are used to reading from left to right or right to left in virtually every human language. But reading the periodic table up and down, column by column, as in some forms of Japanese, is actually more significant. Doing so reveals a rich subtext of relationships among elements, including unexpected rivalries and antagonisms. The periodic table has its own grammar, and reading between its lines reveals whole new stories.